Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. One criticism of Silicon Valley is its lack of diversity. The tech industry is largely dominated by white and Asian males. And allegations of sexism in companies such as Uber have brought this issue to the forefront as an example of how company culture may be driving away women and people of color. A new study from the KPOR Center for Social Impact looked at the reasons why people leave the tech industry. Joining us now is the study's author, Chief Research Officer at the KPOR Center for Social Impact, Allison Scott. Welcome to the show, Allison.
Thank you very much, Anne. Thanks for having me.
Nearly 40% of those surveyed said that unfairness or mistreatment played a major role in their decision to leave their company. And I was interested to read that not necessarily were they personally affected by that. It was something they observed and they didn't like it.
That's correct. So leaving due to unfairness was the number one reason that we found in the sample for individuals leaving their companies. So this is voluntary turnover. And so that was even almost two times as high as those being recruited away for a better position.
Wow.
And as you mentioned, the effect was not only on individuals who personally experienced unfairness, but observing unfairness and unfair treatment was also significantly related to leaving due to unfairness.
How did the numbers break down in terms of race and gender?
In terms of leaving due to unfairness, we saw across all groups that individuals, there were slight differences. The group that left most due to unfairness was men of color. But there weren't huge differences in terms of unfairness driving turnover by race and gender. We did find that in terms of the experiences with unfairness, that those differed dramatically by race and gender.
How so?
So women experienced far more unfairness than men overall. And then we looked at four different categories of unfairness, from unfair people management practices, stereotyping, sexual harassment, and bullying and hostility. We found that women of color were about 30%, about a third of women of color reported being passed over for promotion. That was more than any other group. One in 10 women reported sexual harassment or unwanted sexual attention. We found that LGBTQ employees were most likely to be bullied. And white and Asian employees were most likely to report negative experiences with performance management.
What's the distinction there? I mean, white and Asian with negative experiences with what?
So in management practices.
Yeah.
So these are things like job duties, perceptions of how leadership was treating them. So very different from things like sexual harassment.
Gotcha.
And
okay.
Stereotyping. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Why did you set out to do this study in the first place?
So as we all know, we've heard a lot of talk about the lack of diversity in tech and also a lot of recent anecdotes and stories from individuals about reasons why they left. So the Uber example is one very prominent one. But we didn't have any knowledge as an industry, as a sector, about what drives turnover and what role turnover could be playing in the lack of diversity that we see across the tech sector.
And turnover is that big of a problem there?
Turnover is a big problem. We don't know how we have some information about turnover being a more frequent issue in tech versus non-tech. But we didn't look at that in the study. But what we did find, interestingly, was that in tech, people were more likely to leave due to unfairness than in non-tech, than individuals who were in technical positions outside of the tech sector.
Why do you think that is? Is there something, expectation, a higher expectation of fairness, and when it doesn't come to fruition, they're more likely to leave and it's more expected in other fields?
I think there are several reasons. I don't think any of them fully explain what we're seeing.
Mm-hmm.
There's definitely a unique tech culture that's been talked about quite frequently, especially in some of these anecdotes of people leaving and their experiences in tech. This is, as you mentioned, this is an industry that's primarily white and male,
mm-hmm.
And so there's a lack of diversity that I think contributes to some of the behaviors that we might see persisting.
You've said that this issue has caused the tech industry to lose an estimated $16 billion a year, which sounds like a lot of money. But frankly, I'm getting inured to it. It's a huge industry and they makes, you know, it seems like maybe it's just a speckle. But is that because of the turnover and the training and so forth?
So in terms of the cost itself, the cost mm-hmm. itself that we calculated was just due to those leaving due to unfairness. So we did an estimate based on the 37% that left in the study due to unfairness, projected out what the annual cost would be for replacing those employees alone. So this, that doesn't include employees that left for other reasons. So you could imagine that number could be tremendously higher.
And are companies very good at, have you had much interest in your study? I mean, are companies interested in this and interested in turning things around?
There's been a lot of interest, and I have to say, over the last couple years, there's been a huge increase in the amount of interest in addressing diversity and inclusion. And actually, as a result of this study, we've had quite a bit of attention from the tech industry and from folks trying to figure out what it is that they can do.
What kind of attention are you getting?
A lot of press coverage. Mm-hmm. We also have a group that we work with in the Bay Area called the Diversity Advocates, which is a group of individuals who are working in diversity and inclusion roles within their companies. And so they are very interested in the findings and how they can apply some of the facts that have been gained from the study into their own companies.
I was kind of surprised, I guess, to read about the LGBT community's dissatisfaction with the tech industry, the bullying that you mentioned mm-hmm. going on, given its location on the West Coast, you know, right there in the palm of San Francisco's mm-hmm. hand, practically, it doesn't make any sense. Where's the insensitivity coming from? What's going on?
Mm-hmm. So interestingly enough, and I do want to make this distinction, that this report and this study was conducted on a national.
National, level. Gotcha.
So nationwide, yes.
Okay.
So even though, as you mentioned, there are Silicon Valley is the home of quite a few tech companies. We made sure to survey a more broad population of employees just to get a nationally representative sample.
All right. So, you know, it's a nationally representative sample. So what kind of bullying are we talking about? What do we mean by this?
So we actually looked, as I mentioned, we looked at the four categories, and we just asked people whether or not they had experienced or observed various different behaviors. So under bullying, it was just very specifically, it said bullying. There was another one for public humiliation, and both of those were the categories that LGBTQ employees reported significantly higher than non-LGBTQ employees. So that is something that you know, we had a laundry list of behaviors and experiences that we were trying to understand whether these things are frequently occurring. But that's definitely one of the things that in future research, we would love to dig deeper and understand what those experiences actually look like. We got some of that information from the open-ended questions and responses, a few of which we included as quotes in the study. But we have a lot more information just anecdotally about their experiences.
So when you hear about advertising to get people, women and people of color, into the tech industry with coding workshops and all that kind of stuff, mm-hmm. Is that affected by these perceptions of the industry from studies like yours?
So one of the things that we definitely wanted to explore, what we've seen a lot of in response to the lack of diversity in tech, mm-hmm. we've seen a lot of investment in pipeline programs or programs that are helping to stimulate interest among the K-12 population, higher education, to broaden the pool of individuals going into tech. And
yeah.
So I think what's important about this study is that it's really demonstrating that that might be great and that that is an important investment. But at the same time, we have to be paying attention to what's happening in tech companies or else we're not going to be able to see the changes that we'd like to see.
Why is diversity seen as an asset in any industry?
I think there's been a bunch of research, so I can speak from a research perspective uh-huh. first. There's been a bunch of research that demonstrates that the increase in diversity of your workforce is associated with increased revenue, profit, innovation. And so all of those things are very key to a company's growth and sustainability.
Yeah.
There's also been some research about satisfaction, and we didn't get too much into this mm-hmm. in this study, but there's been some research about how satisfied individuals are with the diversity and inclusion in their companies and how that affects, retention. Again, and as we demonstrated in this study, the lack of retention is going to cost your company as well. And we've also seen from several blunders that have happened, not just in tech, but across other industries, that without diverse individuals at the table, you can run into challenges in product development, in marketing, et cetera.
So what's next? What are the next set of questions that you ask to pursue this line of questioning?
So we're really interested in understanding, this was kind of just to get a lay of the land.
Yeah.
We're really interested in understanding what companies are doing and what's effective. I think that's the next step. So a lot of companies have started to implement a variety of different diversity and inclusion initiatives, but we don't really have any understanding of how effective those have been, aside from looking at the change in the workforce, employee headcount numbers from year to year. But that doesn't give us a lot of information.
Do you know much about whether people are pursuing action in courts over this sex discrimination, that kind of a thing? Is the industry suffering at all from that?
There are several cases that are either underway or have been recently settled. So I think I'm not sure if tech is more prone to these types of cases than other industries, but there are definitely cases of gender discrimination, racial discrimination, and age discrimination.
Okay. Allison Scott, thanks so much for your time today. Appreciate you.
Thank you for having me.
Allison Scott is the Chief Research Officer at the KPOR Center for Social Impact. We'll have more Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. A five-hour span that stretched into the morning of May 1st ended with three more people dead from gunshot wounds, bringing the number of homicides in Columbus to 45 this year. What's behind the spike and what police want to do about it? That's coming up Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher from 10 to noon on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from thousands of listeners and from Kendall at Granville, nestled in the heart of Central Ohio's rolling hills, yet less than a half hour from Columbus, a life plan community serving older adults in the Quaker tradition. Learn more at kag.kendall.org.
Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It is a fact of life in our digital age that nearly everything we do online is tracked and mined for data. The websites we visit and the posts we like on social media offer bits of information to be collected and sorted by algorithms. Tech companies and government agencies use that data to create digital identities that increasingly shape our daily lives. Joining us now is Assistant Professor of American Culture and Digital Studies at the University of Michigan, John Chaney Lippold. His new book is entitled We Are Data, Algorithms and the Making of Our Digital Selves. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Ann.
Can you give us an example of how data is collected and used to sum up what you're talking about in your book?
For sure. And I invite your listeners, if they're available to do this, is Google the phrase, "What gender does Google think I am?" And in that response, you're going to find a link that will then suggest, based on your web queries and based on your search, based on what websites you visit, a gender and age that is likely distinct from who you actually are. For example, I'm a man in my 30s, but Google thinks that I'm a 65-year-old woman.
Interesting. Why do you think that is?
So the idea then is that these templates of what is gender, what is age, or even who is a terrorist, to think about the NSA, they're not based on real-world ideas of, what terrorism is or what gender or age is. It's rather data patterns. And if your data fits within the template of a woman or fits within the template of a 65-year-old, you're going to be assigned that identity, not because it's wrong, but because the actual definition of what these categories are is completely different from what we normally think of as gender, age or even, yeah, terrorism.
So not only is it sort of creepy to think about this happening, but it's also often impossibly inaccurate.
It's inaccurate in the sense that we can't really talk back to them, because even if you yell at Google, "No, Google, I'm a man," it doesn't really care, because your data suggests a truth that they believe much more than you voluntarily saying, "No, I'm actually a man in my 30s.
Does it really matter to the algorithms in the final analysis, though? They're shooting for something to do something else. It's not about being accurate, right?
That's precisely the case. And so they're more concerned with relevance than accuracy. So if I surf like a woman and I purchase like a woman online, even if I chat or move my mouse like a woman, there are a lot of algorithms that actually check how you move your mouse to see who you are, to try to identify you, that if I do that effectively in the targeted content and ads and even targeted dynamic pricing for plane tickets or hotels, if they actually are fulfilling their, you know, purpose and are seen to be relevant, then it doesn't really matter who I'm identified as long as it's effective and it gets money for Facebook, Google, or it. Yeah, whoever.
When you say how you move your mouse, are you saying if I Google something and I get a list of options, you know, line up there, it depends on which one I pick or where I actually put the cursor?
It's a weird thing. They think that even how you type your password or how you move your mouse just on your computer, not even on the internet, but just how you, you know, gesture with your mouse or how you click a certain box, that has gendered implications. And there's no real accuracy to this. It's just commonality. So if it's 80% sure, why not use it? Another example of this would be that some job sites take the fact that you have a web browser that's not the one that's default loaded onto your computer. So for example, if you have a Mac, Safari is preloaded. But if you download Google Chrome and you submit your resume to a job site with Google Chrome, your job resume will go up in the queue, not because you're better, but because that piece of data has been shown over a long period of time with a lot of different people to be a better effective measurement of a good employee than anything else.
Is there any way somebody can find out all these things and stack the deck?
So that's the thing. People have realized that a lot of the dynamic pricing with plane tickets allows you to have an extraordinarily cheap, if not pennies on the dollar, purchase for a flight to Shanghai, for example. Mm-hmm. But most of the time, there's so many interpretations of you going on. There's so many different ideas of you, but more importantly, those ideas are changing. So Google's idea of gender or even Google's idea of age is changing as new websites are created and as new people search for new terms. So you can never be precisely sure what something means because it's modulating and, you know, dynamically moving alongside the flows of endless amounts of data that we produce every day.
Are these algorithms training themselves or are these human wrought algorithms still?
So this is actually a really big debate in algorithm studies because on one hand, you have humans and you have, you know, people with real lives participating in them and writing them or even producing the data that then is used as what they call a training set to teach the algorithm what something means. But then sooner or later, if it gets enough data, it kind of stops thinking about what it was taught and starts to learn like a really good autodidact. And then it learns things that often the algorithm's intenders didn't mean it to learn, or it tries to make it itself more kind of emergent and innovative, and by becoming more innovative, it loses all, you know, connection to the real world. There's a case of this in the case of Microsoft that they developed this personality called Tay, and Taybot was a Twitter account for a preteen who was supposed to be really cool and you could talk to her, but they've trained it according to movie scripts and to talk like a 14-year-old girl, but then eventually it would learn how people talked to her on Twitter, and then within 48 hours, she became extraordinarily racist, extraordinarily sexist, and they had to take her offline.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest right now is the author of a new book entitled We Are Data, Algorithms and the Making of Our Digital Selves. It's John Chaney Lippold. He's an assistant professor of American Culture and Digital Studies at the University of Michigan. It's an interesting title to have, American Culture and Digital Studies. It's kind of like the two are never apart nowadays.
You're totally right. And there's actually one example that I'm very, very interested in that came to me that connects these two fields very closely. In 2013, with the Snowden document leak, we learned about a lot of different surveillance issues and programs that the NSA was running, one of which was called PRISM. PRISM was the ability for the NSA to get into the sites, servers of Google and Facebook and Microsoft, and then profile users, even if they're domestic, even if they're actually U.S. citizens, in a way to get around the privacy that the Constitution affords those people who are U.S. citizens, the NSA developed what's called a citizenship algorithm. And this algorithm is because, you know, imagine you're online, you don't know who the person is on the other end of the computer. You no real ability to connect to a passport or to a birth certificate, to a driver's license. So instead, they created this algorithm that said if you're 51% foreigner, you can be surveilled. And then if you become 51% citizen, you can't be. This idea then was not related to anything normally known to be, you know, citizenship constituting. It was instead what kind of language you speak, who you talk to, if you encrypt your communications or not, or even if your IP address pulls from a server in Italy versus a server in the U.S.
How much does this impact our everyday lives? I'm not sure I really notice anything except the constant barrage of shoe ads.
It's a really good question because a lot of the, I guess, savviness and efficiency of these algorithmic identifications is based on the fact that you don't recognize them. That often power works best if you think that everything is a choice that you make and everything is fair and equal according to what you assume the world to be. The most, I think, effective way to get to this is that when there's a bunch of data valence about us and these sites and companies and agencies and governments know so much about us, but we know so little about them, there creates this asymmetry of information. That the market, for example, if a commercial company knows more about you than you know about the commercial company, they can charge you more for, in the case of 2014 and Orbitz.com, they found that if people who have a large screen size or who people who use Mac OS as a browser, they're more likely to have disposable income or be a wealthier person. And so when you would try to go for a flight or look for a hotel in 2014 on Orbitz, it would show you front-load higher prices. So often people would have to pay $50-$60 more for a plane ticket because of their data versus, you know, if they had another kind of operating system or a smaller monitor, they would have to pay then $50 less. And so you wouldn't know that you're paying more unless you asked a friend how much he or she was paying for a flight to the same place. But it does have this constitutive effect on, in the case of Orbitz, your bank account, in the case of the NSA and its algorithmic citizenship, your right to privacy, or even there's a case in Wisconsin a couple weeks ago of a guy who was denied parole because an algorithm perceived him and his data to be a recidivist. This is not because he would be, but his data suggested, and the company that owns this algorithm gave information to the parole board, and eventually his hearing was denied and he was sent back to jail.
Is that being challenged in courts?
It's interesting. So it's challenged to the extent that if it's the entirety of the decision is algorithmic, it's not legal. But if a little bit is, then it's just the same as a brief in court or an expert witness.
This starts to remind me of like Black Mirror type stories.
Yeah. It really is. And you can think of this in terms of the Chicago Police Department, that recently they've instituted what's called predictive policing. And predictive policing normally is a block in Columbus, Ohio, is high crime at 4 a.m. on a Tuesday, but then it's low crime on a Wednesday at 10 a.m. So the idea is if you have high crime in certain places, you can send more police officers there, or send more light or put more lighting around it, or maybe even kind of watch it with cameras. The Chicago Police Department went one step further and actually started connecting this similar behavior instead to city blocks, but to people. And so they listed created a list of 400, quote, at-risk people. And these at-risk people were not necessarily, you know, all violent offenders, but they were connected potentially as a victim or a perpetrator of a violent crime based not on the fact that they would do it, but because they were socially tied through data, your contact sheet on your phone or maybe your Facebook friend list, they're two people who were already in police custody for a violent crime. And so if you were at risk, in the case of the Chicago Police Department, the cops would knock on your door and say that we're watching you. So it's kind of terrifying because you have this added surveillance, but the added thing that we also have to appreciate is that this algorithmic interpretation does cull from its offline predecessors. So this algorithm is necessarily going to target people who are people of color, poor people, more than other people who are not less likely or not likely to be connected to the police department, to the criminal justice system.
You've said that our data profiles are being used not just to change what the internet looks like through the ads we see or the posts we see in our feed, but literally to change who we are. And I was wondering, what do you mean by that?
So that's a fascinating question. It's something that's actually very difficult to explain. The best example I can think of is in 2014, Facebook did this very famous study, which they called the emotional contagion experiment. What they did is they had a list of words that they saw were negative and a list of words that they saw were positive. And then they looked at people, and it took about 100,000 people without their permission, and they took away half of them, all negative posts. So if you had a negative friend who was really kind of upset about something, it would remove that friend's status update from your newsfeed, comparable to that positive. So you'd have this two groups, an A and B test, of people who only saw negative and only saw positive. And then they tried to see if that would actually affect the user's emotional mood. And they found correlation that if you only saw negative stuff, you'd actually be less likely to be happy or post positive content, vis-a-vis the other way, which is if you saw only positive content, you'd be more likely to post positive content and less likely to post negative.
Again, another Black Mirror feeling. How do you think a person's right to privacy plays out in a world where so much data is being used without our real understanding of it or when it's even happening?
Yeah, I think that's the exact question that we need to be collectively thinking about, because usually, and we think about the right to privacy as being a constitutional right, but also something that has only been developed in the past 130, 40 years, normally in the U.S. we link the right to privacy to an article written by Warren and Brandeis in 1890 called The Right to Privacy, and they theorized this right not as privacy in general, but what they called the right to be let alone. This, in 1890, was because people were climbing into trees and taking photographs of, like, paparazzi photos of celebrities in their homes, and this, ability to have these cameras invade private spaces was seen to be an innovative breach of privacy. The idea, though, is that there was, in that world, the possibility to actually close yourself off from the public, that you could shut your door and close your blinds and you'd be entirely anonymous to everybody else. With the intervention of the internet and with the, decreasing privacy that we have as our data gets used to profile us, I think we have to really seriously consider what privacy means. I, in my book, try to think about what is the right to be let alone when all of our data is open, when all of our data has the ability to manage and kind of manipulate us. And so for me, it's less about shutting the door or not being seen, but more about having a control of who we are, knowing how we're being treated, and knowing full well if a plane ticket is $50 more because of our data.
By the way, listeners, if anybody's asked what gender does Google think I am, give us a call and tell us what you got. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And you've made the point, and this has come up already in our conversation, that algorithms and data are not neutral and they can be imbued with bias. And it can be, you mentioned with Tay. Is that what you were talking about?
Yes. And there's actually, I think, for me, it's a more compelling example, and it's every class I teach on digital culture, I use this as the first incident of digital culture, because it really brings to bear, I think, the really interesting but also very grave, serious problems that come when we think about digital culture. Because everybody wants to think of digital culture as being disruptive of old forms of power that allows, the small, marginal people to have the same voice as those who don't, or those who aren't marginal. But it's this video that is very Let's just say it's very, very energetically titled HP Computers Are Racist. And it's based on a 2009 HP Media Smart Computer with two people. One is a Black person, one is a white person. And the camera is a facial tracking camera. So it's supposed to follow you as you move around the screen. In the case of this video, the Black man, who we understand as, a person, we can identify him very well, the camera doesn't see him, but immediately when the white woman comes into frame, she's recognized and identified. And then when the Black man comes back into frame, it actually makes the camera not recognize anything. So it's very jarring as well as funny, because the people in the video are very charismatic, but it makes us think about, what is this technology? And if you kind of go through how it works, it's probably because HP computers, who have since fixed the algorithm, HP computers were using people in beta testing who are light-skinned, or maybe who are only white, or they weren't thinking about race in how they interpret, you know, how their algorithm is created. But in the same way, and I really emphasize this in the book, that even algorithms are not the newest, or not the only innovative technology that does this, that even cameras back in the day, in 1950s, 1960s, color Kodak cameras, they were balanced to normalize a white face. And so often, black people, when they were in front of them, would have to put Vaseline on their face because the technology was made for white people instead of black people. And so the lighting and the actual way that it would normalize what was white or normal was calibrated again to whiteness.
Which brings us back to our previous conversation with Allison Scott of KPOR, Center for Social Impact, about the importance of diversity in the workplace, particularly in tech workplaces.
Precisely. I mean, I can only imagine that if HP had a bunch of people of color in upper echelon work as well as engineers, they would have caught this problem at the beginning.
Brad in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Brad.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What did Google tell you?
It told me I was a male, which was accurate. But it said I was 45 to 54 years old, and I'm 29.
Do you have any idea why it might think that?
It gave me a list of things that thought I was interested in, and some of them were things that I was looking at buying online, like mattresses, shoes, things like that. So I think certain household items skewed it to thinking that I was older.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I've been told that I act like an old man, so maybe it's just actually accurate to who I am. Who knows?
In its way, right. Brad, thanks a lot for giving us a call.
Yeah, absolutely. Big fan of the show.
Thank you. In its way, it's on point, right? John Cheney Lippold, it's doing what it needs to do. Whether we identify with that age as our own is irrelevant.
I totally agree. With the case of Brad, it's, you know, if an advertiser wants to know if he's interested in mattresses and people who are 45 to 54 are interested in buying mattresses, that is the most effective way to get him to, yeah, maybe buy a mattress or maybe even buy a mattress at a higher price than he would normally do.
Right, depending on what kind of computer he's using.
Precisely, and even what time of day and how tired the computer algorithm might think he is and how loose he is with his wallet.
And whether the next barrage of ads are flowery sheets may depend on how you move your mouse.
Yeah, that is totally possible.
John Cheney Lippold, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much. Have a very good morning.
John Cheney Lippold, Assistant Professor of American Culture and Digital Studies at the University of Michigan and author of a new book entitled We Are Data, Algorithms and the Making of Our Digital Selves. More Tech Tuesday is coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. For many of us, the smartphone is an indispensable gadget that follows us wherever we go. And the germs we encounter in our daily lives are finding a very cozy home in the nooks and crannies of our favorite gadget. Numerous studies have shown phones to carry viruses and bacteria such as E. coli, MRSA, and Streptococcus, just to name a few. So it might be a good idea to include smartphone hygiene in your regular routine. Joining us now with some phone cleaning tips and the latest tech news is contributing editor at AndroidCentral.com, Russell Holly. Welcome back, Russell.
Thanks.
What inspired this as a topic for you today?
Well, so every once in a while, some of the editors that I work with do things like point microscopes at some of our phones to see things like how the, you know, LED panels are aligned, you know, on a display or you know, what the arrangement of pixels are on a display, just because, you know, on some level they're kind of fun to look at and they end up making for some really kind of geeky pictures. And one of the people that I work with did this recently to a phone that he had had in a box for a couple of months that, you know, he hadn't touched in a while. And it was just really super gross. and So it was just, it was a reminder, you know, just how gross these phones get. Even when you're using like a microfiber cloth and you wipe off the glass every once in a while, there's just so much more happening that we can't see, you know, with normal eyes. And it was a good reminder that every once in a while you should probably stop and clean these.
Don't germs just cover everything anyways?
Germs do cover everything anyways, but we don't usually take, you know, things that we hold in our hands and then touch to our faces to places like bathrooms and, you know, hovering above a sink when we're cooking because there's a recipe showing on them so raw meat can, you know, can touch them or things like that. There's,
uh-huh.
there's a lot more that we expose our phone to on a daily basis that we don't really think about because it immediately goes back into our pocket as soon as we're done with whatever that thing is.
And can dirt and grime and all that stuff hurt the phone itself?
You know, there are phones that, you know, older phones that have allowed, you know, things to kind of penetrate the surface. And but most of what we have now, you know, they have an IP rating that is high enough that you don't have to worry about things like sand and grit and moisture and stuff like that getting into the phone.
Mm-hmm. What is your advice for giving your phone a good cleaning?
Really, you know, if you've done something particularly gross with your phone recently, like you're using it in the kitchen and you, you know, accidentally dropped a pork chop or something on it.
Okay.
You know, get some Q-tips and a little bit of rubbing alcohol and you know, just kind of wipe it all down. If you are really concerned about you know, germs and now that you've heard something, you know, on the radio or
yeah, I'm kind of grossed
online,
out right now. Yeah.
Right, and so now just the idea of looking at your phone is super gross. There are other utilities that are out there specifically for, you know, cleaning your phone. There's one that's, you know, an entire cleaning solution that we have linked in that article. There are some lights that are, you know, kind of ultraviolet lights that you can stick your phone under for a little while that you know, neutralize a whole lot of germs that are on the glass surface. If you end up being, you know, kind of really actively paranoid about it, there are some options there. But really, you know, just kind of think about where you take your phone on a daily basis and you know, probably once a month, think about, you know, really getting it clean with, you know, rubbing alcohol is probably the best bet. And most of the time, if you go in and look online for kind of cleaning kits for your phone,
yeah,
they almost always include some kind of spray bottle full of rubbing alcohol or something.
And
similar.
By the way, don't forget the kids' phones.
Yeah, this is definitely something, you know, anyone in the house or if you, you know, kind of pick up any other thing that you would hold close to your face, maybe not necessarily tablets, but along kind of that same line, because, you know, I have never once done it, but I know a lot of people who do things like take their phone into the bathroom and use it while they are, you know, in there and just all kinds of other places. And I know that none of these people ever think about cleaning their phone, you know, immediately before putting that phone right up to their face to talk to somebody. So it's definitely something to give some thought to.
Think, people. Is there danger of damaging your phone when cleaning it? I mean, you should get one of the kits and be on the safe side or like the Q-tips and alcohol.
As long as you're really careful.
Yeah.
No, as long as you're really careful, you know, don't, you know, obviously don't spray anything directly onto the phone. But mm-hmm. if you're using something like an alcohol wipe or a Q-tip, there's really just not enough liquid that can be you know, on those things to you know, permeate your phone to cause the kind of damage that would be required. And if you're really concerned about it, if you accidentally, you know, spill a bottle on it or something, you know, rubbing alcohol is one of those, you know, combinations where you can, you know, just kind of set it long enough to dry
mm-hmm.
and it won't cause any, you know, lasting problems with your phone.
Cable cutters, that is people who are getting rid of their cable, have been turning to Hulu for some time to catch their favorite shows. And Hulu is up in the game now with a new layout and live streaming TV. It's sort of like Sling TV or DirecTV Now, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, in many ways, Hulu was kind of the original cord cutting service.
Yeah.
It offered this way to kind of watch things, you know, on it was originally just online and then it's moved to everything. Everything has a Hulu app now. And in the process, we've seen, you know, DirecTV and Sling Now. YouTube got into, you know, streaming earlier this year. Sony has something built in with their PlayStation service. And they all kind of take live broadcast television and make it available through your streaming devices. And so now Hulu is implementing a really advanced version of this, where you're going to have access to, streaming television from not just, national streaming services, but also a lot of your local channels are going to be available, and sports channels are all included. And it's set up so that each person on your account kind of has their own individual sub account now inside of Hulu. So when you go to Hulu now, you'll have the ability to kind of create a personal profile for yourself that is separate from, say, your partner or your children or something like that. And so now, there are these kind of individual recommendation engines based on what it is that you watch that is built into this. So the app will, when you log in, let you know, what's coming up next that's something you may be interested in, or offer to record something that may be online, that may be broadcasting later. And it all happens wherever you are, because it all happens through the app on the phone. You can stream to a Chromecast or to an Xbox or something on the television and watch it like you would normal television. Or you can, have it available on your phone, or you can just tell it to record, up to 200 hours of video that's all kind of live broadcast television. And it all, becomes recorded online so that you can then download and stream it later.
Yeah, it's in the cloud, right?
Right. The cloud DVR service can be, kind of initiated from anywhere, and it's not something that's stored, in your home. It's all online on your account.
Is it expensive to store that much?
It's an additional $15 a month if you want to store up to 200 gigabytes.
But who does
which
that?
Which is a lot of, of video.
Yeah.
So if you really wanted to go that route, then it is available. But just as an initial kind of early service, it's something that you can grab a quick show if you feel that you need to. And the core Hulu service is still there. So if you already have a bunch of shows that you just kind of watch when they become available on Hulu anyway, that part of the service hasn't changed at all.
What's the difference between Hulu and Sling?
The biggest difference between Hulu and Sling is access. With Hulu, you have kind of an unlimited amount of viewing options when you are at home. So if you have, three Chromecasts and two Xboxes and a PlayStation, all of those devices can be simultaneously watching something on streaming television as a part of your service. And then three other mobile devices not at home, can be watching broadcast television as well, all included in the same plan. Whereas Sling is limited to three devices only on one plan and five on another plan. And so it really just kind of depends on how your house is set up as to which is more advantageous.
Okay. And is it a better deal? It obviously is a better deal than cable or satellite, right?
In most cases, it ends up being, right around $30 or $40 a month, which is going to end up being better for a lot of areas.
Let's turn to laptops. Microsoft has announced its latest. It's called the Surface Laptop. It's part of we've talked about Surface before. It's a line of products from Microsoft. Tell us how it fits into that.
Yeah, so Microsoft's Surface started out as this computer tablet that you could occasionally add a very thin keyboard to if you needed to use it like a laptop. And then last year, we got a Surface that had a more sturdy keyboard that you could attach to it that, gave it some additional battery and felt even more like a laptop. And now Microsoft has decided that what people really want, it turns out, is a laptop. And so they've gone back to, they've kind of completed the circle and gone back to this, this design. It's a touchscreen laptop that doesn't separate in any way. So it's not ever going to be, kind of a tablet mode like the existing services. Mm-hmm. And Microsoft's whole push here is to focus on, students and teachers and create kind of a closed ecosystem where, just the important apps are what's available on these laptops.
It's going to be powered by a new operating system, Windows 10S. What does that bring?
Well, Windows 10S is like I said, it's Microsoft's kind of closing down of the Windows ecosystem by making it so that the only way that you can install new applications and programs is by doing it through the Microsoft Store, which has been, you know, kind of verified and controlled, and you know makes it so that you don't have to worry about things like viruses or anything like that. But it does limit the total number of things that you're able to kind of install and do. So there's kind of an argument right now as to which method is better for offering this kind of security.
And what's Microsoft? Who are they competing with the Surface? Who's their biggest competition?
Well, there was a lot of suspicion because this was supposed to be targeted at students and teachers that the competition here was going to be Google, who has made some significant push in the last couple of years with Chromebooks in classrooms. But Chromebooks start at, you know, $250, $300 and you know, are able to be bought in pretty significant quantities, whereas the Surface laptop starts at $1,000, which is much closer to the pricing that we would see for the MacBook Air. So it seems a lot more likely that Microsoft is competing with, you know, kind of the thinnest and lightest version of Apple's laptop line, which is a lot, you know, how this laptop is designed. It's designed to be very thin, very light, and to have a really long battery.
Yeah, well, and $1,000should get you there.
Absolutely, yeah.
It's starting at that. In other Microsoft news, the company's hosting its Microsoft Build conference later this week. Tell us, for people who aren't familiar with these kind of things, what is a Build conference?
Build is Microsoft's annual developer conference where they make it clear, you know, what the roadmap is for the next year for Windows and for, not necessarily for Xbox, but for anything where they can, you know, get developers in early to build things so that when these things are ready for consumers, when the next update is ready, there's not a big delay for apps to support new features and things like that. This is Microsoft's ability to work with developers to make sure that, you know, when the next thing from Microsoft comes out, all of the things that you already like from Microsoft already work with it.
Who gets to go to these conferences? I mean, like, if I showed up, would I be outed?
No, I don't think so. A lot of times, you know, this is very similar. You know, Google and Apple both have very similar conferences. These are, you know, developers who work for, companies who are already making popular apps, or student developers who are, you know, looking to kind of get started in developing, you know, things for, you know, maybe larger companies or just for themselves. It's really, you know, a lot of focus on, programmers and developers and less on, you know, different products that are being made, which is why the new laptop was announced last week instead of here at this big conference.
So what do you expect to hear about out of the conference?
I think the biggest thing that we're going to see here is more utilities for things like Microsoft Cortana service to be embedded in things like speakers and be able to compete with the Amazon Echo and with, you know, what we're seeing with Google Home. And we'll probably see a lot more from what Microsoft is calling mixed reality to make sure that there are lots of apps and experiences available for when that comes out later this year.
And mixed reality being virtual/augmented.
Right. It's virtual reality with cameras that make it so that you can, you know, kind of see what's going on in the real world, too.
Cortana doesn't get the same kind of press that Google and Amazon get for their digital assistants. How does it distinguish?
Well, the biggest thing that Cortana had when it started was the ability to kind of chain together commands. So it was much more like you were having a conversation with the virtual assistant. You could ask the weather, and then you could ask another question, and the information from the previous answer would be, you know, kind of interact with the next answer. Mm-hmm. And that was something that was kind of a new feature that you know, Siri still doesn't do very well, and Google Assistant has only really started doing. And the biggest reason that, you know, Cortana doesn't get as much attention is that, you know, it originally started on things like Windows phones, which there aren't nearly as many of as there are iPhones and Android phones. And so the biggest push for Microsoft right now is to get Cortana on things that people are more likely to use, like the Xbox or laptops or, speakers that they can put in their home.
Okay, Russell Holly, we're out of time. Thank you so much for your time today. Appreciate it as always.
Thanks for having me.
That's Russell Holly. He's contributing editor at AndroidCentral.com. That's it for Tech Tuesday today. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.